podcasts@millennium.se. I have no managing editor 2 weeks before we go to press, and my investigative reporter is sitting out in Sandhamn refusing to talk to me. Mika, I'm on my knees. Can you come in? Erika. From mikhail.blomqvist@millennium.se to erika.berger@millennium.se. Hold out another couple of weeks, then we'll be home free. I'll start planning for a December issue that's going to be unlike anything we've ever done. The piece will take up 40 pages. M. From erika.berger@millennium.se to mikhail.blomqvist@millennium.se.
40 pages? Are you out of your mind?
From mikhail.blomqvist@millennium.se to erika.berger@millennium.se. It's going to be a special issue. I need 3 more weeks. Could you do the following? 1. Register a publishing company under the Millennium name. 2. Get an ISBN number. 3. Ask Krista to put together a cool logo for our new publishing company. And 4. Find a good printer that can produce a paperback quickly and cheaply. And by the way, we're going to need capital to print our first book. Kisses, Mikhail. From erika.berger@millennium.se to mikhail.blomqvist@millennium.se.
Special issue. Book publisher. Money. Yes, master. Anything else I can do for you? Dance naked at Slussplan? E. P.S. I assume you know what you're doing, but what do I do about Dahlmann?
From mikhail.blomqvist@millennium.se to erika.berger@millennium.se. Don't do anything about Dahlmann. Tell him he's free to go right away and you aren't sure you can pay his wages anyway. Monopoly isn't going to survive for long. Bring in more freelance material for this issue. And hire a new managing editor, for God's sake. M. P.S. Slussplan? It's a date. From erika.berger@millennium.se to mikhail.blomqvist@millennium.se.
Slussplan, in your dreams. But we've always done the hiring together. Ricky.
From mikhail.blomqvist@millennium.se to erika.berger@millennium.se. And we've always agreed about who we should hire. We will this time too, no matter who you choose. We're going to scupper Venestrom. That's the whole story. Just let me finish this in peace. M. In early October, Salander read an article on the internet edition of the Hedestad Courier. She told Blomqvist about it. Isabella Wanger had died after a short illness. She was mourned by her daughter Harriet Wanger, lately returned from Australia. Encrypted email from erika.berger@millennium.se to mikhail.blomqvist@millennium.se.
Hi, Mikhail. Harriet Wanger came to see me at the office today. She called 5 minutes before she arrived, and I was totally unprepared. A beautiful woman, elegant clothes and a cool gaze. She came to tell me that she'll be replacing Martin Wanger as Henrik's representative on our board. She was polite and friendly and assured me that the Wanger Corporation had no plans to back out of the agreement. On the contrary, the family stands fully behind Henrik's obligations to the magazine. She asked for a tour of the editorial offices, and she wanted to know how I see the situation. I told her the truth, that it feels as if I don't have solid ground under my feet, that you have forbidden me to come to Sandhamn, and that I don't know what you're working on, other than that you are planning to sink Venestrom. I assumed it was okay to say that she is on the board, after all. She raised an eyebrow and smiled and asked if I had doubts that you'd succeed. What was I supposed to say to that? I said that I would sleep a little easier if I knew exactly what you were writing. Geez, of course I trust you, but you're driving me crazy. I asked her if she knew what you were working on. She denied it, but said that it was her impression that you were extremely resourceful with an innovative way of thinking. Her words. I said that I also gathered that something dramatic had happened up in Hedestad, and that I was ever so slightly curious about the story regarding Harriet Wanger herself. In short, I felt like an idiot. She asked me whether you really hadn't told me anything. She said that she understood that you and I have a special relationship, and that you would undoubtedly tell me the story when you had time. Then she asked if she could trust me. What was I supposed to say? She's on the Millennium Board, and you left me here totally in the dark. Then she said something odd. She asked me not to judge either her or you too harshly. She said she owed you some sort of debt of gratitude, and she would really like it if she and I could also be friends. Then she promised to tell me the story someday if you couldn't do it. Half an hour ago she left, and I'm still in a daze. I think I like her. But who is this person? Erica. P.S. I miss you. I have a feeling that something nasty happened in Hedestad. Krista says that you have a strange mark on your neck.
From mikael.blomqvist@millennium.se to erica.berger@millennium.se. Hi, Ricky. The story about Harriet is so miserably awful that you can't even imagine it. It would be great if she could tell you about it herself. I can hardly bring myself to think about it. By the way, you can trust her. She was telling the truth when she said that she owes a debt of gratitude to me. And believe me, she will never do anything to harm Millennium. Be her friend if you like her. She deserves respect. And she's a hell of a businesswoman. M. The next day, Mikhail received another email. From harriet.vanger@vangerindustries.com to mikhail.blomqvist@millennium.se. Hi, Mikhail. I've been trying to find time to write to you for several weeks now, but it seems there are never enough hours in the day. You left so suddenly from Hedeby that I never had a chance to say goodbye. Since my return to Sweden, my days have been filled with bewildering impressions and hard work. The Vanger Corporation is in chaos, and along with Henrik, I've been working hard to put its affairs in order. Yesterday, I visited the Millennium offices. I'll be Henrik's representative on the board. Henrik has filled me in on all the details of the magazine's situation and yours. I hope that you will accept having me show up like this. If you don't want me or anyone else from the family on the board, I'll understand. But I do assure you that I'll do all I can to support Millennium. I am in great debt to you, and I will always have the best of intentions in this regard. I met your colleague, Erica Berger. I'm not sure what she thought of me, and I was surprised to hear that you hadn't told her about what happened. I would very much like to be your friend, if you can stand to have anything more to do with the Vanger family. Best regards, Harriet. P.S. I understood from Erica that you're planning to tackle Venestrom again. Dear Froda told me how Henrik pulled a swifty on you, as they say in Australia. What can I say? I'm sorry. If there's anything I can do, let me know. From mikhail.blomqvist@millennium.se to harriet.vanger@vangerindustries.com. Hi, Harriet. I left Hedeby in a big hurry and am now working on what I really should have been spending my time on this year. You'll be advised in plenty of time before the article goes to press, but I think I can say that the problems of the past year will soon be over. I hope you and Erica will be friends, and of course I have no problem with you being on Millennium's board. I'll tell Erica about what happened, if you think that's wise. Henrik wanted me never to say anything to anyone. Let's see. But right now I don't have the time or the energy, and I need a little distance first. Let's keep in touch. Best, Mikhail. Salander was not especially interested in what Mikhail was writing. She looked up from her book when Blomqvist said something, but at first she could not make it out. Sorry, I was talking aloud. I said that this is horrible.
What's horrible?
Venestrom had an affair with a 22-year-old waitress, and he got her pregnant. Have you read his correspondence with his lawyer?
My dear Mikhail, you have 10 years of correspondence, emails, agreements, travel arrangements, and God knows what on that hard drive. I don't find Venestrom so fascinating that I'd cram 6 gigs of garbage into my head. I read through a fraction of it mostly to satisfy my curiosity, and that was enough to tell me that he's a gangster.
Okay. He got her pregnant in 1997. When she wanted compensation, his lawyer got someone to try to convince her to have an abortion. I assume the intention was to offer her a sum of money, but she wasn't interested. Then the persuading ended up with a heavy holding her underwater in a bath until she agreed to leave Venestrom in peace. And Venestrom's idiot writes all this to the lawyer in an email. Of course encrypted, but even so. It doesn't say much for the IQ of this bunch.
What happened to the girl?
She had an abortion, and Venestrom was pleased. Salander said nothing for 10 minutes. Her eyes had suddenly turned dark.
"One more man who hates women," she muttered at last.
She borrowed the CDs and spent the next few days reading through Venestrom's emails and other documents. While Blomqvist kept working, Salander was up in the sleeping loft with her power book on her knees, pondering Venestrom's peculiar empire. An idea had occurred to her, and she could not let it go.
Most of all, she wondered why it had not occurred to her sooner. In late October, Mikhail turned off his computer when it was only 11 in the morning. He climbed up to the sleeping loft and handed Salander what he had written. Then he fell asleep. She woke him that evening and gave him her opinion of the article. Just after 2 in the morning, Blomqvist made the last backup of his work. The next day he closed the shutters on the windows and locked up. Salander's holiday was over. They went back to Stockholm together. He brought up the subject as they were drinking coffee from paper cups on the Vaxholm ferry. "What the two of us need to decide is what to tell Erica. She's going to refuse to publish this if I can't explain how I got hold of the material." Erica Berger, Blomqvist's editor-in-chief and long-time lover. Salander had never met her and was not sure that she wanted to either. Berger seemed like some indefinable disturbance in her life.
"What does she know about me?"
"Nothing." He sighed. "The fact is that I've been avoiding her ever since the summer. She's very frustrated about the fact that I couldn't tell her what happened in Hederstadt. She knows, of course, that I've been staying out at Sandhamn and writing this story, but she doesn't know what it's about."
"Hmm."
"In a couple of hours she'll have the manuscript. Then she's going to give me the third degree. The question is, what should I tell her?"
"What do you want to tell her?"
"I'd like to tell her the truth." Salander frowned. "Lisbeth, Erica and I argue almost all the time. It seems to be part of how we communicate, but she's absolutely trustworthy. You're a source. She would rather die than reveal who you are."
"How many others would you have to tell?"
"Absolutely no one. It will go to the grave with me and Erica. But I won't tell her your secret if you don't want me to. On the other hand, it's not an option for me to lie to Erica, make up some source that doesn't exist." Salander thought about it until they docked by the Grand Hotel. Analysis of consequences. Reluctantly, she finally gave Blomqvist permission to introduce her to Erica. He switched on his mobile and made the call. Berger was lunching with Malin Eriksson, whom she was considering hiring as managing editor. Eriksson was 29 years old and had been working as a temp for 5 years. She had never held a permanent job and had started to doubt that she ever would. Berger called her on the very day that Malin's latest temp job ended to ask if she would like to apply for the Millennium position.
"It's a temporary post for 3 months," Berger said. "But if things work out, it could be permanent."
"I've heard rumours that Millennium is having a difficult time,"
Berger smiled.
"You shouldn't believe rumours. This Dahlman that I would be replacing,"
Eriksson hesitated,
"he's going to work at a magazine owned by Hans Erik Wennerström."
Berger nodded.
"It's hardly a trade secret that we're in conflict with Wennerström. He doesn't like people who work for Millennium. So if I take the job at Millennium, I would end up in that category too."
"It's very likely, yes."
"But Dahlman got a job with Monopoly Financial Magazine, didn't he?"
"You might say that it's Wennerström's way of paying for services rendered. Are you still interested?"
Eriksson nodded.
"When do you want me to start?"
That's when Blomqvist called. She used her own key to open the door to his apartment. It was the first time since his brief visit to the office at Midsummer that she was meeting him face to face. She went into the living room and found an anorexically thin girl sitting on the sofa, wearing a worn leather jacket and with her feet propped up on the coffee table. At first, she thought the girl was about 15, but that was before she looked into her eyes. She was still looking at this creature when Blomqvist came in with a coffee pot and coffee cake.
"Forgive me for being completely impossible," he said.
Berger tilted her head. There was something different about him. He looked haggard, thinner than she remembered. His eyes had a shamed expression, and for a moment he avoided her gaze. She glanced at his neck. She saw a pale red line, clearly distinguishable.
"I've been avoiding you. It's a very long story, and I'm not proud of my role in it. But we'll talk about that later. Now I want to introduce you to this young woman. Erica, this is Lisbeth Salander. Lisbeth, Erica Berger, editor-in-chief of Millennium, and my best friend." Salander studied Berger's elegant clothes and self-confident manner,
and decided after 10 seconds that she was most likely not going to be her best friend. Their meeting lasted 5 hours. Begger twice made calls to cancel other meetings. She spent an hour reading parts of the manuscript that Blomqvist put in her hands. She had 1,000 questions, but realized that it would take weeks before she got them answered. The important thing was the manuscript, which she finally put down. If even a fraction of these claims were accurate, a whole new situation had emerged. Berger looked at Blomqvist. She had never doubted that he was an honest person, but now she felt dizzy and wondered whether the Wennerström affair had broken him, that what he had been working on was all a figment of his imagination. Blomqvist was at that moment unpacking 2 boxes of printed-out source material. Berger blanched. She wanted, of course, to know how it had come into his possession. It took a while to convince her that this odd girl, who had said not one word during the meeting, had unlimited access to Wennerström's computer. And not just his. She had also hacked into the computers of several of his lawyers and close associates. Berger's immediate reaction was that they could not use the material, since it had been obtained through illegal means. But, of course, they could use it. Blomqvist pointed out that they had no obligation to explain how they had acquired the material. They could just as well have a source with access to Wennerström's computer who had burned everything on his hard drive to a CD. Finally, Berger realized what a weapon she had in her hands. She felt exhausted and still had questions, but she did not know where to begin. At last, she leaned back against the sofa and threw out her hands.
"Mikhail, what happened up in Hedestad?"
Salander looked up sharply. Blomqvist answered with a question.
"How are you getting along with Harriet Wanger?"
"Fine, I think. I've met her twice. Prista and I drove up to Hedestad for a board meeting last week. We got drunk on wine."
"And the board meeting?"
"She kept her word."
"Ricky, I know you're frustrated that I've been ducking you and coming up with excuses not to tell you what happened. You and I have never had secrets from each other, and all of a sudden there's 6 months of my life that I'm not prepared to tell you about."
Berger met Blomqvist's gaze. She knew him inside and out, but what she saw in his eyes was something she had never seen before. He was begging her not to ask. Salander watched their wordless dialogue. She was no part of it.
"Was it that bad?"
"It was worse. I've been dreading this conversation. I promised to tell you, but I've spent several months suppressing my feelings while Wennerström has absorbed all my attention. I'm still not ready. I'd prefer it if Harriet told you instead."
"What's that mark around your neck?"
"Lisbeth saved my life up there. If it weren't for her, I'd be dead."
Berger's eyes widened. She stared at the girl in the leather jacket.
"And right now you need to come to an agreement with her. She is our source."
Berger sat for a time, thinking. Then she did something that astonished Blomqvist and startled Salander. She surprised even herself. The whole time she'd been sitting at Mikhail's living room table, she had felt Salander's eyes upon her. A taciturn girl with hostile vibrations. Berger stood up and went around the table and threw her arms around the girl. Salander squirmed like a worm about to be put on a hook.
Chapter 29. Saturday, November 1st to Tuesday, November 25th. Salander was surfing through Wennerström's cyber empire. She had been staring at her computer screen for almost 11 hours. The idea that had materialized in some unexplored nook of her brain during the last week at Sandhamn had grown into a manic preoccupation. For 4 weeks she had isolated herself in her apartment and ignored any communication from Armansky. She had spent 12 hours a day in front of her computer, some days more, and the rest of her waking hours she had brooded over the same problem. During the past month she had had intermittent contact with Blomqvist. He, too, was preoccupied, busy at the Millennium offices. They had conferred by telephone a couple of times each week, and she had kept him updated on Wennerström's correspondence and other activities. For the 100th time she went over every detail. She was not afraid that she had missed anything, but she was not sure that she had understood how every one of the intricate connections fitted together. This much-discussed empire was like a living, formless, pulsating organism that kept changing shape. It consisted of options, bonds, shares, partnerships, loan interest, income interest, deposits, bank accounts, payment transfers, and thousands of other elements. An incredibly large proportion of the assets was deposited in post office box companies that owned one another. The financial pundits' most inflated analyses of the Venestrom Group estimated its value at more than 900 billion kroner. That was a bluff, or at least a figure that was grossly exaggerated. Obviously, Venestrom himself was by no means poor. She calculated the real assets to be worth between 90 and 100 billion kroner, which was nothing to sneeze at. A thorough audit of the entire corporation would take years. All in all, Salander had identified close to 3,000 separate accounts and bank holdings all over the world. Venestrom was devoting himself to fraud that was so extensive it was no longer merely criminal, it was business. Somewhere in the Venestrom organism there was also substance. Three assets kept showing up in the hierarchy. The fixed Swedish assets were unassailable and genuine, available to public scrutiny, balance sheets, and audits. The American firm was solid, and a bank in New York served as the base for all liquid capital. The story was in the business with the post office box companies in places such as Gibraltar and Cyprus and Macau. Venestrom was like a clearinghouse for the illegal weapons trade, money laundering for suspect enterprises in Colombia, and extremely unorthodox businesses in Russia. An anonymous account in the Cayman Islands was unique. It was personally controlled by Venestrom, but was not connected to any companies. A few hundredths of a percent of every deal that Venestrom made would be siphoned into the Cayman Islands via the post office box companies. Salander worked in a trance-like state. The account, click. Email, click. Balance sheets, click. She noted down the latest transfers. She tracked a small transaction in Japan to Singapore, and on via Luxembourg to the Cayman Islands. She understood how it worked. It was as if she were part of the impulses in cyberspace, small changes, the latest email. One brief message of somewhat peripheral interest was sent at 10 p.m. The PGP encryption program, Rattle Rattle, was a joke for anyone who was already inside his computer and could read the message in plain text. Berger has stopped arguing about the ads. Has she given up, or does she have something cooking? Your source at the editorial offices assured us that they were on the brink of ruin, but it sounds as if they just hired a new person. Find out what's happening. Blomqvist has been working at Sandhamn for the past few weeks, but no one knows what he's writing. He's been seen at the editorial offices the past few days. Can you arrange for an advance copy of the next issue? H.E.W. Nothing dramatic. Let him worry. Your goose is cooked, old man. At 5:30 in the morning, she turned off her computer and got out a new pack of cigarettes. She had drunk five Cokes during the night, and now she got out a sixth and went to sit on the sofa. She was wearing only knickers and a washed-out camouflage shirt advertising Soldier of Fortune magazine with the slogan, "Kill them all and let God sort them out." She realized that she was cold, so she reached for a blanket which she wrapped around herself. She felt high, as if she had consumed some inappropriate and presumably illegal substance. She focused her gaze on the street lamp outside the window and sat still while her brain worked at top speed. Mama, click. Sister, click. Mimi, click. Holger Palmgren. Evil Fingers. And Armansky. The Job. Harriet Wanger, click. Martin Wanger, click. The Golf Club, click. The lawyer Bureman, click. Every single fucking detail that she couldn't forget, even if she tried. She wondered whether Bureman would ever take his clothes off in front of a woman again, and if he did, how was he going to explain the tattoos on his stomach? And the next time he went to the doctor, how would he avoid taking off his clothes? And Mikael Blomqvist, click. She considered him to be a good person, possibly with a practical pig complex that was sometimes a little too apparent. And he was unbearably naive with regard to certain elementary moral issues. He had an indulgent and forgiving personality that looked for explanations and excuses for the way people behaved, and he would never get it that the raptors of the world understood only one language. She felt almost awkwardly protective whenever she thought of him. She did not remember falling asleep, but she woke up at 9 a.m. with a crick in her neck and with her head leaning against the wall behind the sofa. She tottered to the bedroom and fell back to sleep. It was, without a doubt, the biggest story of their lives. For the first time in a year and a half, Berger was happy in the way that only an editor who has a spectacular scoop in the oven can be. She and Blomqvist were polishing the article one last time when Salander called him on his mobile.
"I forgot to say that Venestrom is starting to get worried about what you've been doing lately, and he's asked for an advance copy of the next issue."
"How do you know?" "Oh, forget that. Any idea what he plans to do?"
"Nix. Just one logical guess."
Blomqvist thought for a few seconds.
"The printer," he exclaimed.
Berger raised her eyebrows.
"If you're keeping a lid on the editorial offices, there aren't many other possibilities, provided none of his thugs is planning to pay you a night-time visit."
Blomqvist turned to Berger.
"Book a new printer for this issue. Now. And call Dragan Armansky. I want security here at night for the next week."
Back to Salander.
"Thanks."
"What's it worth?"
"What do you mean?"
"What's the tit worth?"
"What would you like?"
"I'd like to discuss it over coffee. Right now."
They met at the café bar on Hornsgarten. Salander looked so serious when Blomqvist sat down on the bench next to her that he felt a pang of concern. As usual, she came straight to the point.
"I need to borrow some money."
Blomqvist gave her one of his most foolish grins and reached for his wallet.
"Sure. How much?"
120,000 kroner.
"Steady, steady."
He put his wallet away.
"I'm not kidding. I need to borrow 120,000 kroner for, let's say, 6 weeks. I have a chance to make an investment, but I don't have anyone else to turn to. You've got roughly 140,000 kroner in your current account right now. You'll get your money back."
No point commenting on the fact that Salander had hacked his bank password.
"You don't have to borrow the money from me," he replied.
"We haven't discussed your share yet, but it's more than enough to cover what you want to borrow."
"My share?"
"Lisbeth, I have an insane fee to cash in from Henrik Wanger, and we're going to finalize the deal at the end of the year. Without you, there wouldn't be a me, and Millennium would have gone under. I'm planning to split the fee with you, 50-50.
Salander gave him a searching look. A frown had appeared on her brow. Blomqvist was used to her silences. Finally, she shook her head.
"I don't want your money.
But I don't want one single kroner from you unless it comes in the form of presents on my birthday."
"Come to think of it, I don't even know when your birthday is."
"You're a journalist. Check it out."
"I'm serious, Lisbeth, about splitting the money."
"I'm serious too. I only want to borrow it, and I need it tomorrow."
She didn't even ask how much her share would be. "I'll be happy to go to the bank with you today and lend you the amount you need. But at the end of the year, let's have another talk about your share." He held up his hand. "And by the way, when is your birthday?"
"On Valpurgis night," she replied. "Very fitting, don't you think? That's when I gather round with a broom between my legs."
She landed in Zurich at 7:30 in the evening, and took a taxi to the Matterhorn Hotel. She had booked a room under the name of Irene Nesser, and she identified herself using a Norwegian passport in that name. Irene Nesser had shoulder-length blonde hair. Salander had bought a wig in Stockholm and used 10,000 kroner of what she had borrowed from Blomqvist to buy two passports through one of the contacts in Plague's international network. She went to her room, locked the door and got undressed. She lay on the bed and looked up at the ceiling in the room that cost 1,600 kroner per night. She felt empty. She had already run through half the sum she'd borrowed, and even though she had added in every kroner of her own savings, she was still on a tight budget. She stopped thinking and fell asleep, almost at once. She awoke just after 5 in the morning. She showered and spent a long time masking the tattoo on her neck with a thick layer of skin-coloured lotion and powder over it. The second item on her checklist was to make an appointment at the beauty salon in the lobby of a significantly more expensive hotel for 6:30 that morning. She bought another blonde wig, this one in a pageboy style, and then she had a manicure, getting pink nails attached to her own chewed ones. She also got false eyelashes, more powder, rouge, and finally lipstick and other makeup. No change from 8,000 kroner. She paid with a credit card in the name of Monica Scholes, and she showed them her British passport with that name. Next stop was Camille's House of Fashion down the street. After an hour she came out wearing black boots, a sand-coloured skirt with matching blouse, black tights, a waist-length jacket and a beret. Every item bore an expensive designer label. She had let the salesgirl make the selection. She had also chosen an exclusive leather briefcase and a small Samsonite suitcase. The crowning touches were discreet earrings and a simple gold chain around her neck. The credit card had been debited 44,000 kroner. For the first time in her life, Salander had a bust line that made her, when she glanced at herself in the full-length mirror, catch her breath. The breasts were as fake as Monica Shaw's identity. They were made of latex and had been bought in Copenhagen, where the transvestites shopped. She was ready for battle. Just after 9, she walked 2 blocks to the venerable Zimmertal Hotel, where she booked a room in Monica Scholl's name. She gave a generous tip to a boy who carried up her suitcase, which contained her travel bag. The suite was a small one, costing 22,000 kroner a day. She had booked it for one night. When she was alone, she took a look around. She had a dazzling view of Lake Zurich, which didn't interest her in the least, but she did spend close to 5 minutes examining herself in the mirror. She saw a total stranger. Big-busted Monica Scholes in a blonde pageboy wig, wearing more makeup than Lisbeth Salander dreamed of using in a whole month. She looked different. At 9:30 she had breakfast in the hotel bar, 2 cups of coffee and a bagel with jam. The cost was 210 kroner. Are these people soft in the head? Just before 10, Monica Scholes set down her coffee cup, opened her mobile and punched in the number of a modem uplink in Hawaii. After 3 rings, the hand-shaking tone began. The modem was connected. Monica Scholes replied by punching in a 6-digit code on her mobile and texting a message containing instructions to start a program that Salander had written especially for this purpose. In Honolulu, the program came to life on an anonymous home page on a server that was officially located at the university. The program was simple. Its only function was to send instructions to start another program in another server, which in this case was a perfectly ordinary commercial ISP offering internet services in Holland. The function of that program, in turn, was to look for the mirrored hard drive belonging to Hans-Erik Wennerström and take command of the program that showed the contents of his approximately 3,000 bank accounts around the world. There was only one account of any interest. Salander had noted that Wennerström looked at the account a couple of times each week. If he turned on his computer and looked at that particular file, everything would appear to be normal. The program showed small changes, which were to be expected based on normal fluctuations in the account during the past 6 months. If during the next 48 hours Wennerström should go in and ask to have the funds paid out or moved from the account, the program would dutifully report that it had been done. In reality, the change would have occurred only on the mirrored hard drive in Holland. Monica Scholes switched off her mobile the moment she heard 4 short tones, confirming that the program had started. She left the Zimmertal Hotel and walked over to Bankhauser General, across the street, where she had made an appointment to see Herr Wagner, the general manager, at 10. She was there 3 minutes ahead of schedule, and she spent the waiting time posing in front of the surveillance camera, which took her picture as she walked into the department with offices for discreet private consultations.
"I need some assistance with a number of transactions," she said in Oxford English. When she opened her briefcase, she let drop a pen from the Zimmertal Hotel, and Herr Wagner politely retrieved it for her. She gave him an arch smile and wrote an account number on the notepad on the desk in front of her. Herr Wagner pigeonholed her as the spoiled daughter, or possibly mistress, of some big shot.
"There are a number of accounts at the Bank of Kronenfeld in the Cayman Islands. Automatic transfer can be done by sequential clearing codes," she said.
"Fräulein Scholz, naturally you have all the required clearing codes?" he asked.
"Aber natürlich,"
she replied with such a heavy accent that it was obvious she had only school-level German. She started reciting several series of 16-digit numbers without once referring to any papers. Herr Wagner saw that it was going to be a long morning, but for a 4% commission on the transactions he was prepared to skip lunch, and he was going to have to revise his pigeonhole for Fräulein Scholes. She did not leave Bankhauser General until just past noon, slightly later than planned. and she walked back to the Zimmertal. She put in an appearance at the front desk before she went up to her room and took off the clothes she had bought. She kept on the latex breasts, but replaced the pageboy wig with Irene Ness's shoulder-length blonde hair. She put on more familiar clothes, boots with stiletto heels, black trousers, a simple shirt and a nice black leather jacket from Mullingsborden in Stockholm. She studied herself in the mirror. Not unkempt, by any means, but she was no longer an heiress. Before Irene Nessa left the room, she sorted through a number of bonds, which she placed inside a thin portfolio. At 1:05, a few minutes behind schedule, she went into Bank Dorfmann, about 70 yards away from Bank Hauser General. Irene Nessa had made an appointment in advance with a Herr Hasselmann. She apologized for being late. She spoke impeccable German with a Norwegian accent.
"No problem at all, Fräulein," Herr Hasselmann said. "How can I be of service?"
"I would like to open an account. I have a number of private bonds that I'd like to convert."
Irene Nessa placed her portfolio on the desk in front of him. Herr Hasselmann examined the contents, hastily at first, and then more slowly. He raised an eyebrow and smiled politely. She opened 5 numbered accounts, which she could access via the Internet and which were owned by an apparently anonymous post office box company in Gibraltar. A broker had set them up for her for 50,000 kroner of the money she had borrowed from Blomqvist. She cashed in 50 of the bonds and deposited the money in the accounts. Each bond was worth the equivalent of 1 million kroner. Her business at the Bank Dorfmann also took more time than expected, so now she was even more behind on her schedule. She had no chance to take care of her final transactions before the banks closed for the day, so Irene Nessa returned to the Matterhorn Hotel, where she spent an hour hanging around to establish her presence. But she had a headache, and went to bed early. She bought some aspirin at the front desk, and ordered a wake-up call for 8 a.m. Then she went back to her room. It was close to 5 p.m., and all the banks in Europe were closed for business, but the banks in North and South America were open. She boosted up her powerbook and uplinked to the net through her mobile. She spent an hour emptying the numbered accounts she had opened at Bank Dorfmann earlier in the day. She divided the money up into small amounts and used it to pay invoices for a large number of fictional companies around the world. When she was done, the money had strangely enough been transferred back to the Bank of Kronenfeld in the Cayman Islands, but this time to an entirely different account than the one from which it had been withdrawn earlier that day. Irene Nessa considered this first stage to be secure and almost impossible to trace. She made one payment from the account. The sum of nearly 1 million kroner was deposited into an account linked to a credit card that she had in her wallet. The account was owned by Wasp Enterprises, registered in Gibraltar. Several minutes later, a girl with blonde pageboy hair left the Matterhorn by a door into the hotel bar. Monica Scholes walked to the Zimmertal Hotel, nodded politely to the desk clerk, and took the lift up to her room. There she took her time, putting on Monica Scholes' combat uniform, touching up her makeup and applying an extra layer of skin cream to the tattoo before she went down to the hotel restaurant, and had an insanely delicious fish dinner. She ordered a bottle of vintage wine that she had never heard of before, though it cost 1,200 kroner, drank one glass, and nonchalantly left the rest before she went into the hotel bar. She left absurd tips, which certainly made the staff notice her. She spent quite a while allowing herself to be picked up by a drunk young Italian with an aristocratic name which she did not bother to remember. They shared 2 bottles of champagne, of which she drank almost 1 glass. Around 11, her intoxicated suitor leaned forward and boldly squeezed her breast. She moved his hand down to the table, feeling pleased. He did not seem to have noticed that he was squeezing soft latex. At times they were so loud that they caused a certain amount of irritation among the other guests. Just before midnight, when Monica Scholes noticed that a hall porter was keeping a stern eye on them, she helped her Italian boyfriend up to his room. When he went to the bathroom, she poured 1 last glass of wine. She opened a folded piece of paper and spiked the wine with a crushed Rohypnol sleeping tablet. He passed out in a miserable heap on the bed within a minute after she drank a toast with him. She loosened his tie, pulled off his shoes, and drew a cover over him. She wiped the bottle clean, then washed the glasses in the bathroom, and wiped them off too, before going back to her room. Monica Schulz had breakfast in her room at 6 and checked out of the Zimmertal at 6:55. Before leaving her room, she spent 5 minutes wiping off fingerprints from the door handles, wardrobes, toilet, telephone, and other objects in the room that she had touched. Irene Nesser checked out of the Matterhorn around 8:30, shortly after the wake-up call. She took a taxi and left her luggage in a locker at the railway station. Then she spent the next few hours visiting 9 private banks, where she distributed some of the private bonds from the Cayman Islands. By 3 in the afternoon, she had converted about 10% of the bonds into cash, which she deposited in 30 numbered accounts. The rest of the bonds she bundled up and put in a safe deposit box. Irene Nesser would need to make several more visits to Zurich, but there was no immediate hurry. At 4:30 that afternoon, Irene Nesser took a taxi to the airport, where she went into the ladies' room and cut up Monica Scholl's passport into little pieces, flushing them down the toilet. The credit card she also cut up and put the bits in 5 different rubbish bins, and the scissors too. After September 11th, it was not a good idea to attract attention by having any sharp objects in your baggage. Irene Nesser took Lufthansa flight GD890 to Oslo, and caught the airport bus to the Oslo train station, where she went into the ladies' room and sorted through her clothes. She placed all items belonging to the Monica Schulz persona, the pageboy wig and the designer clothes, in 3 plastic bags, and tossed them into 3 different rubbish containers and waste baskets in the train station. She put the empty Samsonite suitcase in an unlocked locker. The gold chain and earrings were designer jewellery that could be traced. They disappeared down a drain in the street outside the station. After a moment of anxious hesitation, Irene Nesser decided to keep the fake latex breasts. By then she did not have much time and took on some fuel in the form of a hamburger from McDonald's, while she transferred the contents of the luxury leather briefcase to her travel bag. When she left, the empty briefcase remained under the table. She bought a latte to go at a kiosk and ran to catch the night train to Stockholm. She arrived as the doors were closing. She had booked a private sleeping berth. When she locked the door to her compartment, she could feel that for the first time in 2 days, her adrenaline levels had returned to normal. She opened the compartment window and defied the no-smoking regulations. She stood there sipping at her coffee as the train rolled out of Oslo. She ran through her checklist to be sure that she had forgotten no detail. After a moment, she frowned and rummaged through her jacket pockets. She took out the complimentary pen from the Zimmertal Hotel and studied it for several minutes before she tossed it out of the window. After 15 minutes, she crept into bed and fell asleep. Epilogue. Final Audit. Thursday, November 27th to Tuesday, December 30th. Millennium's special report on Hans-Erik Wennerström took up all of 46 pages of the magazine, and exploded like a time bomb the last week of November. The main story appeared under the joint byline of Mikael Blomqvist and Erika Berger. For the first few hours, the media did not know how to handle the scoop. A similar story just a year earlier had resulted in Blomqvist being convicted of libel, and it had also apparently resulted in his being dismissed from Millennium. For that reason, his credibility was regarded as rather low. Now the same magazine was back with a story by the same journalist, containing much more serious allegations than the article for which he had run into so much trouble. Some parts of the report were so absurd that they defied common sense. The Swedish media sat and waited, filled with mistrust. But that evening, she, on TV4, led off with an 11-minute summary of the highlights in Blomqvist's accusations. Berger had lunched with the host several days earlier and given her an advance exclusive. TV4's brutal profile scooped the state-run news channels, which did not clamber onto the bandwagon until the 9 o'clock news. By then, the TT wire service had also sent out its first wire with the cautious headline, "Convicted Journalist Accuses Financier of Serious Crime." The text was a rewrite of the TV story, but the fact that TT addressed the subject at all unleashed feverish activity at the conservative morning newspaper and at a dozen of the larger regional papers as they reset their front pages before the presses started rolling. Up until then, the papers had more or less decided to ignore the Millennium allegations.
The liberal morning newspaper commented on Millennium's scoop in the form of an editorial, written personally by the editor-in-chief earlier in the afternoon. The editor-in-chief then went to a dinner party as TV4 started broadcasting its news program. He dismissed his secretary's frantic calls that there might be something to Blomqvist's claims with these later famous words.
Nonsense! If there were, our financial reporters would have found out about it long ago.
Consequently, the liberal editor-in-chief's editorial was the only media voice in the country that butchered Millennium's claims. The editorial contained phrases such as personal vendetta, criminally sloppy journalism, and demands that measures be taken against indictable allegations regarding decent citizens. But that was the only contribution the editor-in-chief made during the debate. That night, the Millennium editorial offices were fully staffed. According to their plans, only Berger and the new managing editor, Malin Eriksson, were due to be there to handle any calls, but by 10 p.m. the entire staff was still there. And they had also been joined by no fewer than 4 former staff members and half a dozen regular freelancers. At midnight, Malm opened a bottle of champagne. That was when an old acquaintance sent over an advance copy from one of the evening papers, which devoted 16 pages to the Venestrom affair under the headline, The Financial Mafia. When the evening papers came out the next day, a media frenzy erupted, the likes of which had seldom been seen before. Eriksson concluded that she was going to enjoy working at Millennium. During the following week, the Swedish Stock Exchange trembled as the securities fraud police began investigating. Prosecutors were called in and a panicky selling spree set in. 2 days after the publication, the Minister of Commerce made a statement on the Venestrom affair. The frenzy did not mean, however, that the media swallowed Millennium's claims without criticism. The revelations were far too serious for that. But unlike the first Venestrom affair, this time Millennium could present a convincing burden of proof. Venestrom's own emails and copies of the contents of his computer, which contained balance sheets from secret bank assets in the Cayman Islands and 2 dozen other countries, secret agreements, and other blunders that a more cautious racketeer would never in his life have left on his hard drive. It soon became clear that if Millennium's claims held up in a court of appeals, and everyone agreed that the case would end up there sooner or later, then it was by far the biggest bubble to burst in the Swedish financial world since the Kreuger crash of 1932. The Venestrom affair made all the Gotabank imbroglios and Trustor frauds pale in comparison. This was fraud, on such a grand scale that no one even dared to speculate on how many laws had been broken. For the first time in Swedish financial reporting, the terms organized crime, mafia, and gangster empire were used. Venestrom and his young stockbrokers, partners, and Armani-clad lawyers emerged like a band of hoodlums. During the first days of the media frenzy, Blomqvist was invisible. He did not answer his emails and could not be reached by telephone. All editorial comments on behalf of Millennium were made by Berger, who purred like a cat as she was interviewed by the Swedish national media and important regional newspapers, and eventually also by a growing number of overseas media. Each time she was asked how Millennium had come into possession of all those private and internal documents, she replied simply that she was unable to reveal the magazine's source. When she was asked why the previous year's exposé of Venestrom had been such a fiasco, she was even more Delphic. She never lied, but she may not always have told the whole truth. Off the record, when she did not have a microphone under her nose, she would utter a few mysterious catchphrases, which, if pieced together, led to some rather rash conclusions. That is how a rumour was born that soon assumed legendary proportions, claiming that Mikael Blomqvist had not presented any sort of defence at his trial, and had voluntarily submitted to the prison sentence and heavy fines, because otherwise his documentation would have led inevitably to the identification of his source. He was compared to role models in the American media who had accepted jail rather than reveal their sources, and Blomqvist was described as a hero in such ludicrously flattering terms that he was quite embarrassed. But this was no time to deny the misunderstanding. There was one thing that everyone agreed on. The person who had delivered the documentation had to be someone within Venestrom's most trusted circle. This led to a debate about who the deep throat was. Colleagues with reason to be dissatisfied, lawyers, even Venestrom's cocaine-addicted daughter and other family members were put up as possible candidates. Neither Blomqvist nor Berger commented on the subject. Berger smiled happily, knowing that they had won when an evening paper on the third day of the frenzy ran the headline, "Millennium's Revenge." The article was an ingratiating portrait of the magazine and its staff, including illustrations with a particularly favourable portrait of Berger. She was named the Queen of Investigative Journalism. That sort of thing won points in the rankings of the entertainment pages, and there was talk of the Big Journalism Prize. 5 days after Millennium fired the first salvo, Blomqvist's book, The Mafia Banker, appeared in bookshops. The book had been written during those feverish days at Sandhamn in September and October, and in great haste and under the utmost secrecy, it was printed by Halvik's Reklam in Morgengåva. It was the first book to be published under Millennium's own logo. It was eccentrically dedicated to Sally, who showed me the benefits of the sport of golf. It was a brick of a book, 608 pages in paperback. The first edition of 2,000 copies was virtually guaranteed to be a losing proposition, but the print run actually sold out in a couple of days, and Berger ordered 10,000 more copies. The reviewers concluded that this time, at any rate, Mikhail Blomqvist had no intention of holding back, since it was a matter of publishing extensive source references. In this regard, they were right. Two-thirds of the book consisted of appendices that were actual copies of the documentation from Venestrom's computer. At the same time as the book was published, Millennium put the texts from Venestrom's computer as source material in downloadable PDF files on their website. Blomqvist's extraordinary absence was part of the media strategy that he and Berger had put together. Every newspaper in the country was looking for him. Not until the book was launched did he give an exclusive interview to She on TV4, once again scooping the state-run stations. But the questions were anything but sycophantic. Blomqvist was especially pleased with one exchange when he watched a video of his appearance. The interview was broadcast live at the very moment when the Stockholm Stock Exchange found itself in free fall and a handful of financial yuppies were threatening to throw themselves out of windows. He was asked what was Millennium's responsibility with regard to the fact that Sweden's economy was now headed for a crash. "The idea that Sweden's economy is headed for a crash is nonsense," Blomqvist said. The host of She on TV4 looked perplexed. His reply did not follow the pattern she had expected, and she was forced to improvise. Blomqvist got the follow-up question he was hoping for. "We're experiencing the largest single drop in the history of the Swedish Stock Exchange, and you think that's nonsense?" "You have to distinguish between two things, the Swedish economy and the Swedish stock market. The Swedish economy is the sum of all the goods and services that are produced in this country every day. There are telephones from Ericsson, cars from Volvo, chickens from Scan, and shipments from Kiruna to Skövde. That's the Swedish economy, and it's just as strong or weak today as it was a week ago." He paused for effect and took a sip of water. "The stock exchange is something very different. There is no economy and no production of goods and services. There are only fantasies in which people from one hour to the next decide that this or that company is worth so many billions more or less. It doesn't have a thing to do with reality or with the Swedish economy." "So you're saying that it doesn't matter if the stock exchange drops like a rock?"
"No, it doesn't matter at all," Blomqvist said in a voice so weary and resigned that he sounded like some sort of oracle. His words would be quoted many times over the following year. Then he went on. "It only means that a bunch of heavy speculators are now moving their shareholdings from Swedish companies to German ones. So it's the financial knowns that some tough reporter should identify and expose as traitors. They're the ones who are systematically, and perhaps deliberately, damaging the Swedish economy in order to satisfy the profit interests of their clients." Then She on TV4 made the mistake of asking exactly the question that Blomqvist had hoped for.
"And so you think that the media don't have any responsibility?"
"Oh, yes. The media do have an enormous responsibility. For at least 20 years, many financial reporters have refrained from scrutinizing Hans-Erik Venestrom. On the contrary, they've actually helped to build up his prestige by publishing brainless, idolatrous portraits. If they had been doing their work properly, we would not find ourselves in this situation today."
Blomqvist's appearance marked a turning point.
In hindsight, Berger was convinced that it was only when Blomqvist went on TV and calmly defended his claims that the Swedish media, in spite of the fact that Millennium had been all over the headlines for a week, recognized that the story really did hold up. His attitude set the course for the story. After the interview, the Wennerström affair imperceptibly slipped from the financial section over to the desks of the crime reporters. In the past, ordinary crime reporters had seldom or never written about financial crime, except if it had to do with the Russian mob or Yugoslav cigarette smugglers. Crime reporters were not expected to investigate intricate dealings on the stock exchange. One evening paper even took Blomqvist at his word and filled two spreads with portraits of several of the brokerage house's most important players who were in the process of buying up German securities. The paper's headline read, "Selling Out Their Country." All the brokers were invited to comment on the allegations. Every one of them declined. But the trading of shares decreased significantly that day, and some brokers who wanted to look like progressive patriots started going against the stream. Blomqvist burst out laughing. The pressure got to be so great that somber men in dark suits put on a concerned expression and broke with the most important rule of the exclusive club that made up the innermost circles of Swedish finance. They commented on a colleague. All of a sudden, retired industrial leaders and bank presidents were appearing on TV and answering questions in an attempt at damage control. Everyone realized the seriousness of the situation, and it was a matter of distancing themselves as quickly as possible from the Wennerström group and shedding any shares they might hold. Wennerström, they concluded almost with one voice, was not, after all, a real industrialist, and he had never been truly accepted into the club. Some pointed out that he was just a simple working-class boy from Norrland, whose success may have gone to his head. Some described his actions as a personal tragedy. Others discovered that they had had their doubts about Wennerström for years. He was too boastful, and he put on airs. During the following weeks, as Millennium's documentation was scrutinized, pulled apart, and pieced together again, the Wennerström empire of obscure companies was linked to the heart of the international mafia, including everything from illegal arms dealing and money laundering for South American drug cartels, to prostitution in New York, and even indirectly to the child sex trade in Mexico. One Wennerström company registered in Cyprus caused a dramatic stir when it was revealed that it had attempted to buy enriched uranium on the black market in Ukraine. Wennerström's apparently inexhaustible supply of obscure post office box companies seemed to be cropping up everywhere, linked to all manner of shady enterprises. Berger thought that the book was the best thing Blomqvist had ever written. It was uneven, stylistically, and in places the writing was actually rather poor. There had been no time for any fine polishing, but the book was animated by a fury that no reader could help but notice. By chance, Blomqvist ran into his old adversary, the former financial reporter William Borg, in front of Kvarnen, when Blomqvist, Berger, and Malm took the evening off to celebrate the Santa Lucia holiday along with the magazine's other employees, going out to drink themselves senseless at the company's expense. Borg's companion was a very drunk girl, about Salander's age. Blomqvist's loathing for Borg was palpable. Berger interrupted the macho posturing by taking Blomqvist by the arm and leading him into the bar. Blomqvist decided that when the opportunity arose, he would ask Salander to do one of her personal investigations of Borg, just for form's sake. During the whole media storm, the main character in the drama, the financier Wennerström, was for the most part invisible. On the day that Millennium published its article, the financier was forced to comment on the text at a press conference that had been called for a different purpose. He declared the allegations unfounded and said that the documentation referred to was fabricated. He reminded everyone that the same reporter had been convicted of libel only 1 year before. After that, only Wennerström's lawyers would answer questions from the media. 2 days after Blomqvist's book came out, a persistent rumour began circulating that Wennerström had left Sweden. The evening papers used the word fled. During the second week, when the securities fraud police tried to contact Wennerström, he was nowhere to be found. In mid-December, the police confirmed that Wennerström was formally sought, and on the day before New Year's Eve, an all-points bulletin was sent out via the international police organizations. The very same day, one of Wennerström's advisers was seized at Arlanda as he was boarding a plane for London.
Several weeks later, a Swedish tourist reported that he had seen Wennerström get into a car in Bridgetown, the capital of Barbados. As proof of his claim, the tourist submitted a photograph, taken from quite a distance away, showing a white man wearing sunglasses, an open white shirt, and light-coloured slacks. He could not be identified with certainty, but the evening papers contacted stringers who tried without success to track down the fugitive billionaire. After 6 months, the hunt was